Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
How would you like to die? Most of us don't like thinking about this because, you know, we don't actually want to be dead. But what if instead of dying, you could make it look like you'd done so and then take your very much alive body somewhere else to start a brand new life? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It's hard to know exactly how many people successfully fake their own deaths in any given year. By definition, we only hear about the ones who get caught. But as my guest learned, the fantasy of disappearing by dying without actually doing so is surprisingly common. And it turns out there's a cottage industry of professionals willing to help you do it. Elizabeth Greenwood teaches in the creative writing program at Columbia University. Her new book is called Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud. Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You got to thinking about this when you tallied up everything you owned in student loans. How seriously were you tempted to just vanish?
Well, I think that like many, the fantasy was very pronounced and I was like, how can I just get out of here and without the feds catching me? It wasn't that serious. One thing I learned through the process of my research and reporting is that student loan debt, while it is, you know, odious and it was such an albatross for many Americans, it's actually not, doesn't rate that high on the reasons why people fake their deaths. Usually there's a bit more urgency when you are confronting pseudocide.
Well, pseudocide is the pseudo pseudo-death, which is a kind of a great term. One surprising thing you learned is that if you are not trying to skip out on debts or fraudulently collect a life insurance policy or stay out of jail or something, there's not technically a law against faking your own death.
That's exactly right. There's no law on the books called faking your own death. A lot of the attendant crimes that you will run into supporting your life on the lam might catch you some kind of sentence. So, for example, if you are fleeing a jail sentence, then that is obstruction of justice. If you are going to assume a different identity in your second life, then that's identity theft or identity fraud. There is this very narrow little space that you can occupy where you fake your death and do not commit any other crimes, although it's very, very difficult.
You opened the book by obtaining your own death certificate. Tell us a little bit about how you managed that and lived to tell about it.
So in the course of talking to lots of different investigators who look into particularly life insurance fraud and look at it by traveling all over the world to investigate claims, they get flagged in the home office for a number of reasons. They mention the Philippines time and again as kind of ground zero hotspot where a lot of the death fraud cases they were investigating came out of. And beyond just talking to life insurance investigators, I'd read so much in different reports and news stories about there being a very robust industry supporting death fraud in the Philippines to the degree of black market morgues where you can go and purchase a cadaver to cremate immediately and try to pass off as yourself. So I'd known forever and ever that the Philippines was somewhere I wanted to visit. And then toward the end of my reporting, I went and I got hooked up with two amazing local fixers in Manila by the names of Snooky and Bong. And Snooky and Bong and I spent a day just kind of going through all the motions of what it would take to get a death certificate, an accompanying police report detailing my fatal car crash that brought me dead on arrival to a Manila hospital, witness statements, all these things. So that is how I got my death certificate.
Where does the cadaver come from?
That's a great question. So It's not, for the record, I never acquired my own cadaver. I didn't go that far. I only went to death on paper, which actually, at least for, in many cases, you don't really need to go to that extent of getting a body, of sourcing a body. The reason people will do that when they're attempting life insurance fraud is because without a body, the life insurance company will not pay the claim for 7 years. So people will often acquire corpses to kind of expedite that process. The acquiring the cadavers, right. So not even always will these morgues be black market. They'll just be municipal morgues that, you know, are very kind of poorly funded, and they have, you know, kind of an excess of inventory that they're trying to get rid of. So it can even be the sort of thing where you go in and, you know, make a description of whatever individual fits the profile of who you're trying to collect life insurance for, and you know they'll show you a few, and you just kind of weep over it and say, "Oh, it's Uncle Marco," and you know, you make a compelling enough act, you'll be able to pay to have that body released.
Okay, now help me understand the life insurance fraud thing, because you know, if I die tomorrow, my life insurance is not payable to me. So how are people
trying to
cash in on these policies on their own heads?
Right. So in order to commit life insurance fraud, you need a trusted co-conspirator. And finding the right trusted co-conspirator is one of the biggest challenges for people, often because the beneficiary of your life insurance is a husband or a wife or a child. So, you know, if you really want to go for it, you have to pull them in to your fraud and make them accessories to this crime. You really do have to be in cahoots with someone close to you.
There was one guy who hid very close to home. His wife was obviously aware of what happened. Tell us a little bit about him.
So that's a great story out of the UK about a man named John Darwin. In 2002, John Darwin, and by his description, he calls himself Mr. Boring. He wasn't, you know, one of these high-profile, white-collar financiers who absconds with investor money. He was just a regular Joe. He was a corrections officer, former teacher. He had gotten into some very deep real estate debt. He and his wife decided that, you know, he was worth more dead than alive. And in March of 2002, he staged a kayaking accident with the help of his wife. She picked him up a few hours after he set out in his kayak on the high seas and helped him defect to the opposite side of the country, where he camped out on the beach and became very gaunt and grew this long beard and elaborate disguise. 2 months later, he returned to his own community, Seton Carew, England, where he lived. And he and his wife had this Victorian home where they rented out half of it as apartments. So he came back and lived as a tenant in his own home, which was joined to, you know, where his wife was living, ostensibly mourning him. He had two adult sons who thought he was dead the whole time. While he was back in Seton Carew, he managed to obtain an authentic UK passport in the name of a person called John Jones, who was born around the same time as him, but who died in childhood. And with that passport, he set off on a journey around the world. He traveled to a dozen countries. He purchased property in Panama. And in 2008, he turned himself into a London police station, claiming that he had amnesia and could not account for events prior to the year 2000.
That is a crazy story. And you actually spoke to him.
Yes, I had the great privilege of spending about a week with him in Seton Carew. He did 3 years and 3 months in prison, and he had been released recently when I saw him. And he was living went back to the same town. He has a thing for that town. Now, ironically, he lives in the Philippines. I mean, I couldn't make that up, but
by coincidence, right?
Exactly, by coincidence. But at the time, he was living in Seton, Carew, and he showed me the beach where he did it. He walked me to the parking lot where his wife picked him up, and, you know, we walked along the waterfront, and he told me that there were, you know, many times when he'd be walking along, just as he did when in his first life, but now in this elaborate disguise, presumed dead, and he would pass people he knew, former coworkers. He once passed his own father out on one of these walks while he was presumed dead.
It's hard to imagine passing someone who had cared about you and not instantly being overcome with the desire to sort of make all their dreams come true and say, I'm actually still alive.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. For John particularly, and I've heard this from other people who fake their deaths, they had kind of considered it not as a permanent move, but really as a kind of temporary fix to their problems. So in John's case, he had hoped to fake his death, cash out on some life insurance and pensions, and then be able to use that money to pay back the debts that he had gone into. And, you know, again, he had two sons who thought he was dead, and he didn't want them forever to think he was alive. So he saw it as this temporary fix to a pretty big problem. And unfortunately, it really doesn't work that way. And when he came back from the dead, you know, it was quite a shock to both of his sons, and he remains estranged from one of them to this day.
What kind of help can one hire in order to disappear? Before you get to the Philippines, who might have counseled you to go there?
That's a good question, and it's a good opportunity to make this distinction between disappearing and faking your own death. Hmm. So the difference being, when you commit suicide, you stage a hoax accident that imposes a narrative on what it is that happened to you. So, for example, if you are trying to, for whatever reason, fake your death, that your circumstances in your life are such that that is the best solution for you, and you leave your wallet and clothes and towel folded on a beach, and, you know, you make it look like you went for a swim, then it looks like you went and drowned, or, you know, you committed suicide by water. Disappearing has less of a story attached to it. So disappearing is kind of your classic case of dad goes out for cigarettes and never comes back. It's just more open-ended. There's more of a mystery. And many of the experts and investigators I spoke to actually encourage disappearing as a more effective means of getting out of Dodge than faking your own death. When you fake your death, there's just more to investigate, and the pieces have to align just so, whereas disappearing is more open-ended, it's more elegant. In a lot of ways, it's more effective. So one of the people I profile in my book is a man named Frank Ahern, who is the author of a book called How to Disappear, and he is also a quote-unquote privacy consultant. He will help you disappear. So Frank has helped 30 people, I think more or less 30 people disappear, charging up to $30,000 for his services. And what he does is he was, before he got into the disappearing business, he was a skip tracer. And a skip tracer is essentially an unlicensed private investigator. So they don't really bother with things like warrants and the laws and all those pesky details. So Frank could find anyone as a skip tracer just by seeing kind of where people mess up, usually by following trails they leave behind through anything, really, utility bills, looking at property, any kind of footprint you leave in the world as a skip tracer, Frank would follow to locate you. So because he really knew how people got themselves caught, he inverted his business model to help people disappear.
We're speaking this hour with Elizabeth Greenwood, who teaches in the creative writing program at Columbia University. Her new book is called Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Elizabeth Greenwood, who teaches in the creative writing program at Columbia University. Her new book is called Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, Elizabeth, you were telling us about Frank Ahern, who used to be a skip tracer, kind of reverse engineered his business to, instead of finding people who had disappeared, to help people disappear. One of the things he told you was that the less money someone has, the easier it is for them to disappear.
That's exactly right. And that was something that was kind of simultaneously shocking and refreshing to me. I was like, okay, if I really want to do this, I'll be good. So the reason for that is because there are just fewer assets to dissolve and therefore less to trace. So if all of a sudden in the same, you know, 6-month period, you are selling your house, liquidating your portfolio, that's going to raise some red flags. So, you know, I think as he told me, he said, you know, give me a waitress without a house and I'll have her gone in no time. So yeah, the less money you have, it is somewhat easier.
Of course, you need something to live on before you have established some kind of new identity somewhere else.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the trickiest parts. So again, if you're hoping to avoid committing, you know, lots of law breaking, I think that the kind of classic suitcase full of cash is probably the way to go. Or, you know, establishing lots of prepaid credit cards that you can get, just something that's not going to leave, again, that much of a mark for people to follow. And in your next life, if you were some kind of licensed professional, for example, if you're a doctor or a lawyer, you can't do that in your next life because, again, the paper trail. So it's finding a way that you can earn enough money for yourself off the books.
So do you have to build your new identity, whoever you intend to be, if you're going to fake your death and take up life as someone else? Do you have to start that years before you actually make good on your pseudo side?
You have to start so far out in advance, it seems like either your real death would befall you first before you could start using your new identity. One of the investigators I interviewed at length is a man named Steve Rombaum, and he consults for a number of different life insurance companies. And we went through kind of all the steps of what you would do to make this believable, to pull it off. And in terms of establishing a credit history, you would need to start that, according to Steve, decades in advance. Because if an investigator is looking at this person, this new person who exists on paper, and all of a sudden on August 15th, 2016, they just start going through all the motions of a normal person. Well, where were they before this? So to make it believable, you really have to start, you know, decades in advance.
All right. So if you were going to go through this, the advice that you've ended up with is rather than faking a drowning, fake a hiking disappearance. What's different about one over the other?
So I think that as lay people, when we think about how we would fake our deaths, we always go to water accidents as our first, you know, foolproof plan. Because, of course, when you fake your death, you have this onus of a body and producing one. And, you know, if all things go well, you're going to hold on to your own body. So then what? We think, okay, drowning, I'll be at the bottom of the ocean, fish food, good as gold. Well, that's actually one of the biggest red flags for law enforcement and life insurance fraud investigators. Very often in any drowning or water accident, a body will wash up eventually, usually in the first few days. Sometimes they will drag a reservoir in order to find it. So we all kind of think we're Jason Bourne when we come up with that water plan. But really, it's kind of amateur hour. So don't do the drowning. Disappearing while hiking, though, again, we're thinking about situations that are more elegant, more open-ended. Unfortunately, lots of people do disappear when hiking, and it's just kind of a more open scenario.
There's a poignancy to this because I think anyone who's ever lost anyone has fantasized that person faked their own death and that someday they will walk back through the door, even when, you know, there is evidence to the contrary. And it is horrific to those who are left behind if they discover the fraud. Can you tell us about Lisa Boozen?
Yes, Lisa Boozen is an incredible, incredible woman. She lives in Los Angeles, and I found her because she wrote a really great essay for XO Jane about her father who faked his death that I encourage everyone to go check out. It's great. So Lisa had been told since she was a very young girl that her father died when she was a toddler. So she never knew him. She had no memory of him. The only kind of artifact of her father's life is this photograph of a Corvette that he was very well known for. His kind of heyday was in the late 60s in the Sunset Strip of Los Angeles. He was known, I think he was kind of self-proclaimed, King Michael of the Sunset Strip. And he had a very minor role in an Andy Warhol film. So Lisa carried this photograph with her all throughout her adult life, and she had just moved into a great apartment in the Los Feliz neighborhood of L.A., and she set this photograph up on a bookshelf and had a friend over for dinner, and her friend was asking her, well, aren't you curious about your dad? You really don't know that much about him. And that evening really kind of struck a nerve with her for whatever reason, and she just went to her computer after her friend left and Googled Michael Boozen plus Corvette, as this was his kind of identifying feature. And up came in the search results an interview with Michael Boozen from the year, I believe it was 2004. It was very recent. And this really gave her pause. She thought, oh, okay, well, this must have been the date that it was posted. This couldn't have been the date he gave it. And in fact, he had given that interview just years prior. So it turned out he had been alive. Upon doing some more digging around, she then stumbled upon his very real obituary, and it turned out he had died just a few months prior to her doing that search that evening.
Did she ever find out why he faked his own death?
She didn't find out why. There had been, he had been involved in drug trafficking for a while. That's really as far as she knew, was able to establish. I think part of the reason what she told me is because having to revise that part of her biography was just so traumatic. As you can imagine, you go through your life feeling, and also I should mention, her mother died when she was also very young. She was raised by her grandparents. So this was a kind of fundamental part of her identity. And then learning that her dad actually was out there, it's to her, I think she described it to me as the greatest insult in the world. So she really didn't feel all that compelled to go find out more. It was just really very hurtful. And I saw that a lot in people I interviewed and met with who had had a loved one who faked their death. Even if they knew that their parent or loved one was alive and they were actually colluding with that person to commit life insurance fraud, for example, their lives were forever altered. I interviewed once the son of a man who attempted to claim life insurance money. The son actually ended up serving more time in prison than his father for jumping bail reasons. But, you know, it really wasn't so nice.
Okay, I think I have no desire to fake my own death, but if I did it, I would be Googling myself all the time to see whether there were any leads in the case or whether people were still talking about me. This is something you cannot do.
This is something you cannot do. And in this day and age, it's just so tempting to do.
Yeah.
So that's the way one man by the name of Patrick McDermott got himself caught. Patrick McDermott was Olivia Newton-John's ex-boyfriend. He was facing some back child support charges and some personal financial turmoil. He staged a fishing boat accident in Mexico and slinked away. Because of the kind of celebrity connection, Dateline NBC hired a group of investigators to attempt to locate McDermott. And the way they did it is they set up a website, something to the effect of findpatrickmcdermott.com. It was a website dedicated to any tips coming in about McDermott. And what they noticed when they were checking the stats on the website's traffic is that there was a centralized cluster of IP addresses all logging onto this site. So that address was located in Puerto Vallarta. So they ended up just following that digital trail to the spot, and there Patrick McDermott was logging onto his own website.
Wow. And just imagine, in addition to everything else, like the humiliation of being caught that way.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about people I interviewed who fake their deaths is that to actually go through with the plan, you have to have a very high self-regard, because what you're really doing is banking on the fact that you can outwit law enforcement, investigators, fool your loved ones. So while a lot of the people I spoke with were they had regrets about their actions, especially when it came to hurting loved ones, a lot of them were still pretty into the fact that they got away with it for a while. So humiliation, not as much as I would have expected.
Okay, maybe this is just a coincidence, but so far everyone you've told me about that faked their own death has been a man.
That's exactly right. That is a factoid that I really glommed onto and noticed in my reporting. Even Frank Ahern, when he described his disappearing clients, they were predominantly male. When he had women he was helping disappear, it was normally because they were in an abusive relationship and they were fearing for their lives. And for those clients, Frank didn't charge anything. He helped them disappear pro bono. I think when women disappear or fake their deaths, the stakes really are life and death. And I think that it's either two things. It's either women just don't fake their deaths in the same numbers as men do because they have more of a sense of responsibility to their families and their children and maybe can't compartmentalize the same way certain men can, or they do it in equal numbers and they're just better at it and don't get caught and they are presumed dead.
I was surprised that you came to the conclusion that it might actually be easier to fake your own death in the age of the internet than it was before. It would seem to me that, you know, you can't do anything without giving information. And even if you're giving fake information, you're going to be leaving digital traces of yourself everywhere. So how has the internet facilitated the ability to fake your own death or disappear?
Yeah, that point is something that Frank told me. Frank believes that it's easier to disappear in the age of the internet. And the reason why is because you can just plan everything, you know, at your fingertips, really. He describes that when he, you know, back in the 80s, when he was a skip tracer and was finding people, for them to go through with disappearing, you know, you'd have to call up a travel agent and get the flight scheduled to Belize and then maybe send away for a catalog of property you could go buy in Belize. He said now it's really just all at your fingertips, all at your disposal. And he really said it's more of a double-edged sword. It's who's better at utilizing and harnessing this technology, the person disappearing or the people who are after you.
Did you get the sense at any point that any of the sources you spoke to who admitted to having faked their own deaths were lying to you?
Yes. But they didn't go in the book. There were, in the course of, you know, the 6 years I spent reporting and researching this book, I had always wanted and craved so deeply to encounter a story where someone had faked their death for, you know, in my opinion, a noble reason. So not committing life insurance fraud, not getting out of a jail sentence, but because for what, you know, they were unjustly being prosecuted for a crime they didn't commit. And I came across one of these stories. This is someone that I interviewed for several years. And, you know, the first time we got off the phone and he told me this tale, this amazing story of woe and being framed for this crime and how he didn't commit it, I hung up and I was like, finally, I found my faking death hero. And then, you know, just blowing on that story a little bit, pushing back with the most ginger of touches, I realized that a lot of it was not, in fact, true. So, yes, I think that the type of person who will have loved ones and colleagues believe that they are dead maybe doesn't have the same handle on the truth as other people.
How important is it if you are going to fake your own death and start life as another person that you go to a place where you can blend in with the local population? Like, part of me thinks I would go to a distant country where there was no chance of me ever running into anybody I knew, but then I might stick out like a sore thumb.
That's exactly right. I think that if you were to fake your death and disappear, one thing that you want to think about is how you're going to get around. Cars, I found, always get people caught, either because people can't let go of the car that they bought, that they loved in their first life. It's still registered in their name, and then they get pulled over. Or like this great case that I love, a man named Benny Wint. He staged a drowning off the coast of Florida in the 80s, and he managed to successfully live under a different identity, presumed dead from the first drowning, and he was pulled over for a broken taillight. So, you know, there's always that one thing you can't imagine. So I think somewhere where you can enjoy public transportation, where you don't have to drive, that's probably a plus. And I think there is really something to be said for hiding in plain sight, enjoying a kind of, you know, vast population like here in New York where you can blend in with the crowd. I think that could be a way to go.
We're speaking this hour with Elizabeth Greenwood, who teaches in the creative writing program at Columbia University. Her new book is called Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Columbia University writing teacher Elizabeth Greenwood. Her new book is called Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. So, Elizabeth, there are people who fake their own deaths. And then on the other side of things, there are people who are positive that their favorite celebrity who has left the world is in fact faking, and that they are in on something that everybody else is just too blind to realize.
That's exactly right. And the one group of enthusiasts I spent a lot of time among call themselves the Believers. And this is a kind of fringe group of Michael Jackson super fans who insist that the King of Pop is not in fact dead, that he is sending messages through his music and through different kind of emissaries, that he's alive, and, you know, very complex numerology equations for when he'll come back and why. And they were really terrific. I had so much fun hanging out with them and getting to know their philosophy. The woman I spent the most time with is named Pearl Jr., and she blogs and posts a lot of great YouTube videos that I encourage your listeners to go check out. about the Michael Jackson death hoax. And this is very controversial among Michael Jackson fans. A lot of people, you know, including members of the Jackson family themselves, have spoken out saying, you know, this is hurtful. We really wish you'd just let him rest in peace. But for some, they really believe they have the answers.
Pearl is aware that lots of people think she's crazy, at least
she
in
is.
This aspect of her life.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mm-hmm. bother her.
It doesn't bother her. I think, you know, it's so funny. She was just at my book launch here in New York last Tuesday. It was such fun to have her there. And even, you know, in a group of very sympathetic people, she really holds her own. She faces off and she says, this is what I believe and why. And she really does believe in her evidence that she has to back it up. And yeah, I mean, it's very passionate. This cause for her.
When you listen to her side of things and you know, review the clues that she believes Michael Jackson is leaving for his best fans, is there even a part of you that could for a moment be convinced?
Well, when I was with her back a few years back, when I first got to know her and was really plunging myself deeply into this world, there are so many amazing coincidences that around the death hoax, that if you are in any way kind of predisposed to believing conspiracy theories, which I definitely am, you know, just kind of this mental catnip, there is this part of you that's like, huh, I wonder if he did it. And if you kind of let it wash over you just as an accumulation of all of the different factoids and discrepancies, then you can kind of squint and hope it's true. But ultimately, I do believe, sadly, Michael Jackson, R.I.P.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone with Roy in San Antonio. Hi, Roy.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I'm just right now awestruck because of your show. It's just so interesting. I was driving through Dallas. I'm on my way to San Antonio. I drive a truck, and I thought, this is so cool. So I wanted to ask you, what is the percentage of people in America, of our population, that actually try to get away with this and are successful?
Oh, thanks for your call.
It's a great question. Thanks, Roy. It's a great question, and it's such a hard one to answer because people who successfully fake their death will never know. They're just presumed dead. I can tell you that from the life insurance fraud investigators I spoke with, and there are many life insurance fraud investigators out there. I just happened to speak with a handful of the very kind of elite creme de la creme in the industry. They typically investigate, or their firms will look at about a few hundred a year. And those are, again, just policies that are over the $1 million mark, so they would be costly to an insurance company, so they're trying to prevent a payout. And these are usually frauds that occur overseas.
So
that's like the best data.
If you have like a $500,000 policy, the insurance company is just going to, once they've got a death certificate, going to honor that?
Well, it's hard to say what their particular algorithm is, you know, per individual. One thing that we do know is obviously the higher the policy, the less they want to pay that out. So if you were to be more modest in your claim and maybe go for, you know, $20,000 on your life as opposed to $2 million, the chances of them paying an investigator around $1,500 a day to go look into that, it's a lot less. There are also several other red flags for insurance companies. So if you have increased your coverage in the past 2 years and you die, that will automatically get investigated. Again, if it's something like a death by water, automatically fishy. So there are certain things to avoid.
How much money are you advised to squirrel away to live off? Like, for how long should you assume you won't find a job when you are hiding out as a dead person?
Well, I mean, I would say as much as possible that you could squirrel away. I believe when I interviewed Steve Rombaum, the life insurance fraud investigator, about this question, you know, he said that he would want to have $60,000 a year stashed away. And I was like, that's more than I make annually right now. Like, that's how sounds great. I'd be down with that. So I really think it depends on your kind of lifestyle choices, how comfortable you want to be. But probably having as much money cash on hand as possible is a good idea.
As a writer, I don't know if your students are writing fiction or if you also write fiction, but it seems like there's a lot of fodder in this nonfiction work for a novel.
I would think so. I mean, I think that fiction is such the higher art in a lot of ways than what I do. I find real people who are amazing, and then I write about them. I don't have the imagination for fiction, but you know, there were many times when I was on this journey and just hearing people's stories and what they actually did, where I had the thought that if you were to read this in a work of fiction, you'd never believe it. It's just too crazy. So, yeah, that old trope about stranger than fiction, I think it's very real.
And a number of the stories that you tell in this book are really complicated. And you talk about having interviewed people over a matter of years. What did it take to get a sense that you had really absorbed all the details and you were clear on exactly what happened and why?
That's such a good question. And it was, really over years. And these stories were complex in a lot of different ways. They were complex, you know, because of the just actions that people took, and it was sometimes hard to understand, okay, well, how did you get from point A to point B and what was going through your mind? They were also very emotionally complex because I think that for some individuals, there was a lot of bluster and bravado around the act itself, and now this is what they're infamous for. So it was also trying to cut through to see, you know, what was at the core? How did it really feel? What were some of those finer emotional nuances? And I went back to people a lot. I think I really became a thorn in some people's side because I just wanted to keep checking and, you know, say back to them what I understood to be their story. And yeah, that takes time.
Some people get caught because they have committed fraud and somebody is looking for them. It would seem, though, that if somebody stayed, disappeared, and they were supposed to be dead, somebody would still be looking for them forever.
That's exactly right. And that was the big question that I had in my mind the whole way through, especially when experts and investigators were telling me, no, you should just disappear. It's better. Well, of course, there would still be people who were looking for you. So That will happen, I think. And, you know, we see even just on television shows, cold case files and all these things. That was the one reason that I thought if you really, really wanted to put a finale on this iteration of your life, why faking your death would be better. But I've had it said to me so many times, it's just not.
People often talk about, you know, if their house were to catch fire, there's one thing they would grab, a book of family photographs or, you know, a treasured memento of some kind. Did the people that you spoke to that for a while at least successfully faked their own deaths, had they secreted away any kind of possession besides the things that they would need to survive, money and keys and that sort of thing?
That's a great question, and I'm really not sure. I know for John Darwin, he had a whole list of the things that he brought with him in that kayak that day. And it was, you know, two long sleeve shirts, two pairs of pants, socks, candy bars. It was not kind of the sentimental things that you would expect to grab in that fire. I think that when you are in the mind frame to fake your own death, you're really kind of in more of a fight or flight response or reaction to the stimuli around you. And you're really thinking about your own survival. So no one I spoke with at least mentioned those kinds of mementos, but it's very possible that some people have brought that.
It's worth noting that John Darwin, whose wife was his primary accomplice, ended up divorced.
They did end up divorced. They both served prison time in the UK. They divorced while they were in prison. She ended up serving a bit more time than he did because she pleaded not guilty to her crime. And they did divorce, sadly, even after going through such an experience that couldn't keep them together.
And she didn't want to talk to you.
She did not. She, according to what I know from the UK tabloids, they keep very close tabs still on John and Anne Darwin, is she's living in York, England, which is a few hours away from Seton Carew. And from what I can tell, she's really ready to put that chapter of her life behind her. Mm-hmm. And she did not speak to me. I would love to speak with her, though, if she's out there.
You say that your quest to fake your own death, even if you didn't actually intend to disappear, was cathartic for you in a way. And I'm curious to know what's cathartic about holding a copy of what looks like your own death certificate.
It was so cathartic. And it was cathartic because holding that document of my death that in these little rectangles in some bureaucrat's typewriter font just laid out my last day on Earth, which was, you know, getting plowed into during lunch hour on a busy thoroughfare in Manila. My problems that had kind of propelled this quest, which was student loan debt, it just didn't seem like that big a deal anymore. And handling the documents that would then be sent to the embassy, that would be then sent to my mother, my next of kin, and thinking that through, you know, the kind of dross of life didn't seem that burdensome anymore at all. And it seemed like something to be joyful about.
Was it genuinely emotional for you? Like, did it freak you out a little bit?
Oh, it definitely freaked me out. And it kind of took me by surprise because the whole time leading up to actually having it in my hands, I was really approaching it more as the reporter and, you know, having flown across the world and being more scared that I would leave empty-handed without anything. So the whole time leading up to that, I was just really focused on, oh, are we going to get it? Is it going to work out? So then when I actually did have it, I almost wasn't prepared to see what was there. And it really did. It hit me like a ton of bricks. I just said, oh, my goodness. I'm not ready for this yet.
Having done all this research, spoken to people who've done it, people who've helped others do it, if somebody came to you and said, I read your book and I want to go through with this, I want to fake my own death, would you try to talk them out of it?
I would try to talk them out of it. And I hope that by the end of reading my book, they too would want to embrace the dreary parts of life. But if they didn't feel that way, I would, again, ask them to really interrogate their motivations. If you're collecting life insurance fraud, you're probably going to get caught. If you are evading a criminal sentence, there are lots of people looking for you. If you just don't like your life and the state it's in, there are many alterations you can make before deceiving loved ones and your whole community.
Elizabeth Greenwood teaches in the creative writing program at Columbia University. Her new book is called Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud. Elizabeth, I'm glad you're still with us. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Javier Girabet. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and our Twitter handle is at KERAThink. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think. And once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.